You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the race for space started as a contest for countries, but in the last 20 years, private businesses have taken center stage. Look behind the scenes of the companies racing for orbit and beyond with the author of the new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about mothers.
Many of us are grateful for everything our mothers taught us. For Jana Rose Schleiss, she's thankful that her mother taught her how to be beautiful.
I learned how to be a woman from my mom. What I mean is, I learned how to express my femininity from her. This isn't unique to me. For a lot of people, our mother is our first beauty standard. We grow up thinking she's the prettiest woman in the world. For girls, at some point in our lives, we gotta decide what kind of woman we wanna be and how we present that to the world. Through a million minuscule choices, we express ourselves and our femininity. The older I get, the more I realize I've been modeling myself off mom in subtle and not so subtle ways. My mother was a teacher. She also had 5 kids and a dairy farm to help run. When we were younger, she didn't have time for frivolous beauty trends or anything that wasn't practical. My 3 sisters and I, however, wanted everything new and impractical the early aughts could offer. Blue eyeshadow, the infamous Rachel haircut, and oh my gosh, flip-flops. When my mother goes out, her routine is this. Makeup, mascara, a bit of eyeliner, lipstick, hair. A few curls applied to her cropped locks, then brush back. Accessories. She keeps her most worn jewelry in a shot glass in the kitchen cupboard. I don't know how this became the norm. It drives my father, who bought much of it, crazy. She dumps the glass out, chooses a pair of small hooped earrings, and puts the many gold rings she wears on her hands. She's ready. I'm 30 now, and I've had plenty of time to experiment with my femininity. For style, there was the mismatched floral print phase, the crop tops and platforms phase, and this was all just during college. My hair journey has been similarly chaotic. For the few years I was a wannabe hippie, I didn't cut or even brush my hair. I could tell it drove my mother nuts, but she had a light, perhaps sometimes passive-aggressive touch. I'd receive gift cards for haircuts and the quick aside of, run a comb through your hair and then we'll go. But overall, she knew I needed to work through this stuff on my own. I've been dyeing my naturally brunette hair red for 10 years. This vibrant hair has become my brand, if you will. A friend recently asked why I chose this color. I told the story of how it initially happened. I got a horrid haircut before studying abroad. I bought a box of dye and tried to take control of the situation. To my 20-year-old self, this made sense. But looking back, it's obvious why red is the ideal beauty standard to me. For as long as I can remember, my mom's hair has been dyed shades of auburn. By the way she carries herself, my mother has taught me to never be ashamed of my body. She's always seemed so comfortable in hers. Something I'm very thankful for in a world that sends women messages like, you're too fat, you're too tall, you're too loud, you're too assertive, you're too independent, and the choices you've made are wrong. When I was younger, my mom let me be whatever I needed to be. All through puberty and the many confusing chapters after, I could always come to mom. She'd take me and my questions about my body and beauty seriously. I have nieces now, and I know they're watching, taking in the variety of women around them. They giggle at my armpit fuzz, want to touch my nose ring. They'll grow into their femininity one day too, play around with it and try different things. I'm so grateful they have many strong and beautiful women in their lives to take cues from. When I go out, my routine is this. Makeup, mascara, brows, lipstick. Hair, a few curls, brush back. Accessories. From a jewelry box, I choose a variety of cheap gold rings and a pair of earrings. I know I'm ready. I know I'm beautiful because of mom.
Jana Rose Schleiss brought us that story on her beautiful mother. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Space used to be considered the fictional final frontier, science fiction explorers going where no one had gone before. Then real-life countries started to make space travel a reality. People in orbit, then on the moon, probes to our nearest planetary neighbors and beyond, powered by national space agencies and big-name contractors. But then things changed. Our next guest says there was a major turning point when space suddenly became a new open field for private industry and lots of companies who've gotten in on the act. That, he says, is the greatest technology story of our time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow the latest news on space, rockets, and what's going on in Earth's orbit? Have you been following the trials and tribulations of SpaceX, Blue Origin, or the smaller rocket and space commerce startups out there? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ashley Vance is a feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek and the host of the Bloomberg show Hello World, which focuses on inventors and scientists. His books include Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the quest for a fantastic future. His newest book is called When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think when people think of, you know, newer companies getting into the space business, they might think of SpaceX and Elon Musk. Your book highlights there is a lot going on beneath that surface. Can you talk about the variety of players in this rising industry?
Yeah, I mean, SpaceX definitely, I argue in the book, was this inciting incident for what has come since. I don't think most people are aware, which is why I wanted to write this thing, that there are dozens of rocket startups all around the world. There are hundreds of satellite startups all around the world. There are entire nations that are becoming spacefaring nations for the first time. And we're in a bit of a race right now among all these commercial companies to put up many thousands of times more satellites around the Earth than have ever existed before.
What led to the transition between, like I said, you know, a space program is your space agency and some really big name contractors in the aerospace industry, to the idea that lots more players can come in and, you know, maybe with some government support and contracts, of course, and try lots of smaller experimental things?
A lot of it was timing and then also a mentality shift. I think we reached a point where there had been huge advances in materials, huge, huge advances in electronics that helped bring the cost of these rockets down, the cost of satellites down, that made them better, and that also made it feasible for smaller teams to try and do these things as opposed to nation states. And then I think it was just this awakening. Space, it seems futuristic and advanced and all that, but it had been stuck for about 60 years. The underlying technology really had not changed much. And so you suddenly had a group of people who believed they could have a clean slate and do something new.
You share a lot of the personalities behind this as well as the technology. And one of the most interesting ones I thought was this chance meeting, an argument actually at a bar between a bunch of self-proclaimed space hippies and then a military, an Air Force general who had worked on the Strategic Defense Initiative for Star Wars and black operations and things like that. And this was a pivotal moment. Can you share a little of that story?
Yeah, this general's name is Pete Warden. He's one of my favorite people and characters in the book. He was an astrophysicist by training. He was in the Air Force, but through his decades in the military and the government, he'd always been this iconoclastic figure who really wanted to do space differently. And through a series of events, he ended up inheriting, becoming the director of NASA Ames, which is Silicon Valley's NASA center. And he took this as an opportunity to not just change NASA, but space overall. And there was this group of youngsters that he'd met at some of these space conferences. They were space hippies. They were idealistic. They also wanted to do different things in space. And so he flooded NASA Ames with all these 20-somethings. And, you know, NASA had this allergic reaction to this idea they could do things cheaper and better, but many of these people succeeded, and they've started a lot of these commercial space companies that we have today.
And we might see some of the higher profile, you know, rocket launches, like the most recent one from SpaceX. But it seems like a big part of the story is this explosion, I guess, not so dramatic as that one, but a huge rise in the number of satellites up in Earth's lower orbit. Can you talk about the scale of the growth in our satellites?
I don't think people are aware of this, but they should be, which is why I wrote the book. But from about 1960 to 2020, we had a sum total of 2,500 satellites in low Earth orbit. And just in the last 3 years, that number has gone up to 8,000. It's going to double next year. It's going to reach 100,000 satellites within the next decade and possibly keep growing from there. And I argue in the book, what we're doing is building what I describe as a computing shell around the Earth. This is the next stage of our technological advancement and infrastructure, and it just happens to be taking place over our heads as opposed to doing things like laying fiber optic cables under the ground here on Earth.
We're talking to Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What hopes or fears do you have about the commercialization of space? What role should governments, say the U.S. government or international organizations, have in regulating it? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the commercialization of space with Ashley Vance. His new book is When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Superior. Mike, hi.
Hi. I've traveled 49 states and always looking for the darkest experiences, from the loneliest road in Nevada to the southern Alaska, and I found that the best dark sky viewing I've ever seen in my life is in the northern, far northern tip of the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, called Brockway Mountain. And that summer sky there is probably as close to it as any place could be. And it pains me because one night I was up there and I saw what I would call a string of pearls, and I think it was a recent Elon Musk launch of satellites, and it was like six satellites all in a row. And it just pains me to be thinking that those dark skies are going to be completely gone. So if anybody from Wisconsin or the Midwest hears this and wants to see it before it does fade, Mount Brockway up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is probably the best dark sky that I've seen in any of the 49 states.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, not the only one concerned, Ashley, about the changing vision of our night sky because of artificial satellites. I know there's some scientific concern from astronomers as well. Are we going to see enough satellites up there that it's really going to spoil our view?
Yeah, those were almost certainly the SpaceX satellites he was talking about for their Starlink internet system. And this is why I wrote the book now. Nobody's paying attention to this stuff. I mean, my book is optimistic overall because these things are going to do some very important functions for us. But to be honest, you can just expect more and more of that. This is going to be a regular occurrence. Astronomers are concerned. Other people are concerned. I was sort of shocked that astronomers voiced these concerns so late because we all knew what SpaceX was going to do. There is some inevitability to all this now.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And on a related note, Ashley, it's not just looking crowded from here on Earth. There are more and more satellites from governments and militaries and startups, so many that there's another startup that's kind of acting as an air traffic controller?
That's right. Yeah, there's a company called Leo Labs. And obviously we've had government systems for tracking objects in space. This company has built a new type of antenna. They're building a network of antennas around the world. They can see pretty much every object in space down to a couple of centimeters, so even debris from things. But this is the stage we're at. It's great that this company exists. It's also a small 50-person startup that is now in charge of leading the way on managing all of this. And this is, again, the reality people need to be aware of.
Is there a thought that some more organized body is going to come in and start regulating this? I mean, I just try to picture like, okay, we've got all these airplanes in the sky, and then some guy started a business to help make sure they don't crash into each other. It doesn't sound like an ideal system to me.
It's in everyone's best interest, obviously, that this works, especially the satellite companies, because if you have a crash, you have every chance of creating this kind of cascading debris field. And the federal regulators are looking over this. I think they are having trouble keeping up with the pace that this industry is going. They're used to this 60, 70 year old pace that's flipped very quickly. And so I'm not, you know, it's just not at all clear how this is going to play out. But again, for these companies, it's essential that they figure this out. And so they want all of this to work.
Talking to Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, so much of your book is you on the ground, checking out these companies as they succeed or fail at their various experiments. Which companies struck you as ones that, you know, even if they're not household names right now, maybe they should be?
Well, there's a company called Rocket Lab, which is based in New Zealand and was founded by this guy named Peter Beck. And it's an incredible story. He never even went to college. He worked as an apprentice at a dishwasher manufacturer and was building rockets in a shed behind his house. He was making his own propellants. He ended up creating a rocket and then another one, and now a very large company that's valued at several billion dollars and is the second coming of SpaceX. He did all this in New Zealand, which has no aerospace history. He's set pretty much every first you can have for the Southern Hemisphere in terms of aerospace. And just in it's a story that I think points to how far we have come from this being something pursued just by nation states, just by billionaires, that this driven individual and his team were able to pull this off.
Another individual key to another one of these companies you talk about in the book is a Ukrainian named Max Polyakov. I hope I'm saying his name right. Can you share about his story and the company he helped created and ultimately had to leave?
Max is maybe the tragedy in the book. He was an OBGYN by training. He shifted his career in Ukraine to become this multimillionaire software magnate. His parents both worked on the Soviet space program. And a company in Texas that was building a rocket went bankrupt called Firefly, and Max bought it. He put $250 million into this company. Max is an incredibly eccentric, driven, quite chaotic individual, and he ends up being thrown out of his company by the U.S. government. You can check out the book to sort of see how this interplays with the war in Ukraine. But yes, I mean, this is the drama that's taking place in this industry as politics and commerce and all of these new realities collide.
Speaking of realities, this may feel, you know, a way away from us here in Wisconsin, startup companies around the world, stuff happening up in low Earth orbit. How are we going to be feeling the impact of this expansion in the satellites and the things they're doing in the next few years?
The most immediate things that these thousands of satellites are doing are the space internet that we talked about. And so people probably listening have a number of them probably have Starlink, where you get high-speed internet in a place you previously could not be reached by high-speed internet. That same story is true for 3.5 billion people around the world. And then there's a huge class of imaging satellites, which are, as opposed to images from space being rare and very expensive, we are now flooded with millions upon millions of images that capture everything happening, literally everything happening on Earth every day. A company called Planet Labs is the leader in this. And so we're getting this picture of the, I call it like the sum total of human activity on Earth. And in the Midwest in particular, farmers are using these satellites to check on the health of their crops. They can see how much chlorophyll is in the crops and the ideal time to harvest them and the health of their fields.
One thing that struck me just from you being on the ground at so many of these sites, and you write about this, we might picture, you know, a rocket lab, a launch facility as this like amazing piece of set design from the most elaborate science fiction movie. And tell us about the reality. What do these places really look like?
Some of the startups are pretty fancy. Rocket Labs got some fancy things, but the actual launch sites themselves are crazy. they tend to be near the equator. The Earth actually spins faster at the equator. It gives these rockets some extra boost, and that they also tend to be by water, so they don't blow up and hurt things and people. And so I went to India, I went to French Guiana, I went to Svalbard, which is another extreme at sort of the farthest north on our planet, and this is where much of the space infrastructure is. It's quite dated. A lot of this was built in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and it's remote and quite poor. It was just such the opposite of what I was expecting going into reporting on space.
In just our last half minute, this is a business that changes quickly. What is the next big space story you have your eye on?
Well, I really think it's just watching to see if the business case behind all of this stuff arrives. We've pumped $280 billion into this industry. There seems to be a lot of promise, but now is the real test to see just how far this goes and which ones of my characters survive into the next chapter.
Ashley, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
That's Ashley Vance, a feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, host of the travel show Hello World. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.